Democrats in Congress want more intelligence on foreign interference in the 2020 race. Congressman Adam Schiff says election meddling is a threat.
You have to have your head buried in the sand to think that foreign adversaries, Russia in particular, won't seek to intervene again.
Also ahead, Brazil's president is recovering from COVID-19. Jair Bolsonaro wants his country open for business, full stop.
This is a person that denies reality, creates his own reality, and then presents that reality as propaganda.
And museum curators are battling it out. Which collection has the best derriere on display?
I'm always ready to talk bums.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is good to be back with you after a little bit of R&R. Here's a thought for this Wednesday. The U.S. election is just 104 days away, but who's counting? It's 104 more days to bite your nails. The 2016 vote was, of course, marred by charges of foreign interference, and the worry since then is that it'll happen again this year. Concerns are high enough that this week Democratic lawmakers, including Congressman Adam Schiff, the California Democrat, who chairs the House Intelligence Committee, wrote a letter to the FBI demanding a briefing on potential foreign meddling. Congressman Schiff told me he's worried.
Congress really needs to be briefed on this. It should go beyond simply members of the intelligence committees so that the Congress can protect itself against any foreign effort to interfere. Ultimately, I think the information should also be made public so the American people will know what our foreign competitors and adversaries are doing to try to influence the outcome of our presidential election.
There are reports suggesting your concern is related to a possible Russian-backed attempt to smear Vice President Joe Biden's, his campaign, and that the Russian information is being funneled to a committee headed by Senator Ron Johnson. What can you tell us about that?
You know, unfortunately, I can't go into the underlying information, but I can say that I think it's material that all members of Congress should be aware of so that no one is witting or unwitting in terms of what the Russians are doing and how they may seek to launder information through the U.S. Congress. And I hope that all members would support being informed and join in calling for a briefing.
So laundering information through the U.S. Congress, generally, can you differentiate between the kind of interference we saw in 2016 and what congressional interference might look like in 2020 and what its aim might be?
Yes. And, you know, I think it's important to point out that the modalities that a foreign adversary may use to interfere in an election can take many different forms, and some may be consistent from one election to another, and some may be very different. In 2016, we saw the Russians engage in a massive social media campaign. They created false personas. They organized protests in the United States that people thought were organic and local, but were in fact driven out of cubicles in St. Petersburg. They also hacked democratic institutions and released documents to try to drive the campaign debate. And, you know, this cycle, we're seeing some of those same tactics, but we also are seeing new tactics. Other nations may seek also to influence our politics in other ways. And I think those efforts should be exposed as well.
Representative Schiff, the director of the Department of Homeland Security's Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, said on Friday that he has not seen a foreign effort to influence U.S. elections so far this year. He doesn't seem as worried as you are.
Well, he should be worried. I certainly am. I think people that are watching this and having an opportunity to review what our agencies are seeing are worried about this. And I think you have to have your head buried in the sand to think that foreign adversaries, Russia in particular, won't seek to intervene again.
So I know part of the concern is tied up in the story of the work of a Ukrainian lawmaker, Andrei Derkach. He was educated in a KGB-backed school, was at one point close to pro-Russian political factions in Ukraine. In May of this year, he released tapes, including parts of telephone conversations between Biden, then the vice president, and Ukraine's president at the time, Petro Poroshenko. What do those tapes tell us, and how high in your list of concerns are they?
Well, you know, I think there is a kind of an eerie echo of what we saw in 2016 with the hacking and release of documents from the Clinton campaign. Now, we don't know the provenance of these recordings, but I think they're certainly being released with an eye towards trying to influence the election. So, you know, Ukraine, as we saw and as we demonstrated during the impeachment trial, has been a fulcrum in terms of the U.S. president's effort to solicit foreign interference and how foreigners may seek to interfere in our election. And as we heard in expert testimony during the impeachment trial from Dr. Fiona Hill, there were narratives that were being pushed out. In fact, they were being pushed out by Republican members of the House on the Intelligence Committee that I serve on, as well as the president himself, involving this crazy CrowdStrike conspiracy theory. So there is a history here.
Finally, on a different topic, Congressman, the White House and the Department of Homeland Security have been defending the use of federal officers during demonstrations in Portland, Oregon. Is their defense legitimate?
No, it's not legitimate. I think what they're doing is deliberately designed to provoke confrontation in Portland. That's certainly the view of those local officials in Portland who didn't request this federal help, don't want the federal help, saying it's making matters worse. And I'm particularly concerned about the degree to which the Department of Homeland Security is using its intelligence resources to gather information about protesters who are exercising their First Amendment rights. So I think it's a terrible abuse of power designed so that the president can claim that he's a law and order president, when in fact, the president is doing everything he can to stimulate disorder.
So what do you think should happen? What can be done?
Well, I think these federal law enforcement personnel in their camouflage should be immediately withdrawn from these cities where they're much more likely to increase the conflict than they are to suppress it in any way.
Representative Adam Schiff, a California Democrat, he chairs the House Intelligence Committee. Thank you very much, Congressman, for your time.
You bet. Thank you.
It has been 2 weeks since Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, was diagnosed with COVID-19. It did not change his response or attitude toward the pandemic. Quite the opposite, in fact. Bolsonaro is now calling for Brazil's economy to be reopened despite rising cases. He's also praising the controversial drug hydroxychloroquine for his return to health. Michael Fox has more from Brazil.
It's late afternoon on Sunday, July 19th. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro walks across the yard outside the presidential palace and greets a couple hundred avid supporters who have been demonstrating in Brasilia throughout the day. They wear yellow and black t-shirts, many adorned with Bolsonaro's face or the Brazilian flag. Many of them aren't wearing masks, or they're pulled down around their chin or neck. They cheer for Bolsonaro as he approaches. He waves to the crowd across a small body of water. Then he pulls a box of hydroxychloroquine from his pocket and lifts it high into the air with both arms. The crowd erupts. The video goes viral on social media. His opponents joke that it reminds them of the Lion King, baby Simba being raised over Pride Rock. It is a fitting metaphor for Bolsonaro's COVID-19 infection. He's used his illness as a platform to sell both his cynicism about the virus and social restrictions and his praise for chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine. Those are the anti-malaria drugs that the World Health Organization says should no longer be prescribed to COVID-19 patients. Tests have shown they likely offer no benefit and could even increase the risk of death. Nevertheless, Bolsonaro has become the drug's most vocal champion. Here he is in the same spot the day before, also speaking to supporters. He said, "This was my experience. 12 hours after taking the first dose of hydroxychloroquine, I was 100% better. So it worked for me. I'm the living proof." Since the beginning of the pandemic, Bolsonaro has downplayed the virus, fought with state governors over social restrictions, forced out two health ministers, and repeatedly called for the reopening of the economy. He did so again over the weekend. He said, "From what they tell me, no one has died from a lack of ICUs or respirators. So we need to think about the economy. We can't keep talking about lives, lives, lives. Social isolation kills. Without a salary, without a job, you die from hunger." Here's the thing. Brazil has been opening up. Far too soon, according to researchers, analysts, and even a recent report from Citibank Brazil. The country has yet to hit peak, but stores, shopping malls, restaurants, and bars have been getting back to work. With them, the number of cases has risen. Brazil has been averaging more than 1,000 deaths a day from COVID-19 for weeks. More than 80,000 people have died. Bolsonaro's opponents blame the president for the country's failed response to the pandemic that has made it the hardest hit country in the world after the United States. Rogério Carvalho is a former surgeon general of the Brazilian state of Sergipe and a congressman for the Workers' Party, one of Bolsonaro's staunch opponents. He spoke to the Brazilian outlet TVT last week. He said the president is an enemy of the fight against COVID-19. He used chloroquine as a trick to create the false illusion that COVID-19 would be easy to manage because there was a drug. That's also the opinion of Brazil's longtime political blogger, Marcelo Igiarchi. He says, obviously, the president wants people to get back to work soon to boost the economy, which was already shrinking and plummeted during the pandemic. So by praising chloroquine, he's offered a placebo so that people lose their fear of leaving their homes. Chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine were prescribed in severe cases in Brazil since the beginning of the pandemic. But in May, Interim Health Minister General Eduardo Pazuello, who has no medical experience, approved their widespread use across the country. There may be both political and practical reasons behind the government's active promotion of the drugs. According to Brazilian media outlets, the owners of a number of companies that produce chloroquine in Brazil are Bolsonaro supporters, who have met with the president during the pandemic. Additionally, the investigative outlet Reporter Brazil revealed in June that the Army's pharmaceutical laboratory had increased its chloroquine production 100-fold since March, producing 750,000 tablets per month since then. The country now has a glut of product to sell and distribute. For Federico Finkelstein, an Argentine historian at the New School for Social Research, Bolsonaro's insistence on ignoring the medical community is his way of pushing his political agenda.
This is a person that denies reality, creates his own reality, and then presents that reality as propaganda, for the followers and for the whole of Brazilian society. So we are talking about a very radical and fanatic way of doing politics. Basically, what we are seeing is the fascist way of telling lies and then believing those lies.
The Brazilian Medical Association and the Brazilian Society of Infectious Diseases recently joined the WHO in recommending that doctors stop prescribing chloroquine to their patients. But with Bolsonaro on the mend, it's clear that he'll be using his case as a sign of the effectiveness of the treatment for months, regardless of the scientific and medical evidence. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
They say it's non-life-threatening, but when an 84-year-old king, the longtime leader of a nation, goes into the hospital, it raises questions about who's next in line to take power. In Saudi Arabia, that is the scenario currently playing out. It means all eyes are on the crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman.
He wants to show that he is the guy for the position, and he wants to make sure that there are no challenges in his way to the throne.
What a transition of power might look like in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. We've got that story coming up tomorrow. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Today was supposed to be an important one in a courtroom in Malta, a case connected to the 2017 murder of anti-corruption journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia, a woman who was feared by many in high places. A Maltese man was due to give some key evidence in court today, but late last night, Melvin Thuma, who was under police protection, was found in his apartment with serious knife wounds to his neck, ribs, and wrists. Police say the wounds were self-inflicted. Herman Greck is the editor of the Times of Malta newspaper. Before getting to this witness who was set to testify, remind us, if you would, quickly who Daphne Caruana Galizia was.
Well, Daphne was probably Malta's most well-known blogger/journalist. She was brutal in her writing. Sometimes she got personal, but sometimes she landed some really good stories. And she was one of those who actually investigated the Panama Papers in great detail in Malta, to the extent that her investigations at the time actually pushed forward the general election.
So Melvin Thuma, he's this man who was going to testify. He's described as a middleman in the murder of Daphne Caruana Galizia. What does that mean, to be a middleman in the murder?
Well, he confessed himself that he was involved in the assassination of Daphne. He says that he was commissioned by a prominent businessman who happened to be a friend of his, and he was the man who contracted the three hitmen who detonated the car bomb which killed Daphne in October 2017. He was arrested by the police last November, and he told the police at the time, you know, I'm prepared to talk about the murder, provided I get a presidential pardon. He was involved in money laundering himself as well, and he actually said, I will speak up about the case.
So Melvin Thuma essentially turned state's evidence, granted a presidential pardon. And
exactly.
Immunity. So Herman, bring us up to speed. What happened last night? What do you understand happened?
Well, at one point we were alerted that there was a lot of commotion outside his house. The police held a press conference this morning, and the police commissioner said that they were self-inflicted wounds. The lead investigator actually happened to get there before he lost consciousness. And apparently he asked Melvin Thuma who had inflicted these wounds. And Thuma said he did them himself before he passed out. Now, there's a lot of skepticism. There's a lot of people in Malta saying this is might not be true. I mean, why would he try to take his own life? And, you know, there's a lot of distrust in the police force, especially.
Do Maltese believe the police and the police report?
It depends which side you're looking on. But there's a lot of people saying they don't believe the police. Remember, there's one reason behind that. The former police chief was among those who was actually testifying in court this morning, because the claim is that at some point he accepted money from the middleman to help secure him the presidential pardon. This is how complex the web is.
So what is the condition today of Melvin Thuma?
We understand he's still in critical condition. The injuries are very, very serious. But the latest we heard is that he might pull through.
So now what? Is justice for Daphne Caruana Galizia still certain?
We don't know at this stage. There's so many people involved. There's so many people covering the tracks. You could sense the sense of fear today saying, will anybody actually be brought to justice?
Mr. Grech, what has been the political reaction today in Malta to this development?
Bizarrely enough, not much. The Prime Minister has not said a word. The opposition leader said it's just basically, let's be cautious about this, but this is very worrying development. But civil society, the people who have been protesting out there, are really worried and saying, like, something is not quite right. How can you have a state witness who has been under 24-hour police protection end up close to taking his own life? So there are a lot of questions being asked. There's a lot of criticism towards the police today. And the police are just saying, what could we have done? This thing happened inside his own home, and there was a policeman outside his house. What could he have done?
Herman Grech is the editor of the Times of Malta newspaper. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Confinement during this pandemic is tough on everyone, but it's especially hard for children. They need to move around, go outside, and play with friends. In one apartment complex in Mexico City, children there at least have this to look forward to.
Así es como empieza esta historia. En una oscura, oscura colina, había una oscura, oscura ciudad.
That's Percibald Garcia, a local architect who's doing regular readings of children's stories in the apartment complex's public space. He calls the project De la Casa a la Plaza, translated as From the House to the Plaza. Percibald Garcia joins us from Mexico City. How did this idea come about? What made you want to do these public readings, and why specifically for kids?
Me and my mom, we were in Tlatelolco, and suddenly we heard this kid going out of his window screaming like, I'm bored. And then we were like, okay, we need to do something. Like, they are having a really hard time. When this pandemic started, we started to get a lot of things for adults to avoid depression or avoid frustration, like yoga workshops or fitness classes. But no one creates these things for kids. So that's why I decided to do it for kids.
You're a storyteller. You're also an architect. So talk a bit about the space where you're doing this, this large public plaza in this apartment complex in Tlatelolco in Mexico City. What is the significance of that space to you?
Well, first, yeah, I'm an architect. No? So sometimes it's just like, why an architect? It's doing storytelling. I work in this practice called social production of habitats. This practice acknowledges that spaces are not just materials. a space has a cultural, a political, ecological, economical dimension. So it's constructed by a lot of complex, intangible things, you know, situations, connections. We can have a city without buildings, but we cannot have a city without citizens, without persons.
I see exactly what you're saying, but it strikes me as I watch the videos of you reading to those kids, it was so enjoyable, but you're the only one essentially in the plaza. So what is the meaning of a public space if people can't actually occupy the public space anymore?
The thing is, there is many ways of occupying a space. This is a ritual. Every day at 3 p.m., all our eyes, all our attention, all our imagination is inside the plaza, and you can occupy this space in a symbolic way. I have this example. The other day, it was this girl's birthday. Her grandpa came down, and he was like, can you please greet her and play the Mañanitas, which is the happy birthday song in Mexico? And we totally did it.
Muy feliz cumpleaños, Regina.
And when we finished, I told him, wow, like, we just celebrated a birthday in the plaza. I mean, our voices were occupying this space and we reunited to celebrate a girl's birthday. No, so we were creating community. You know, we are imagining and reimagining even though we are inside our apartments.
Percibald Garcia is an architect in Mexico City. He's been holding regular public readings of children's stories, a project he's calling De la Casa a la Plaza. Percibald Garcia, thank you so much for speaking with us. It's a fantastic thing you're doing.
Thank you very much.
Why do you spend time with the world every weekday? How about all the voices that bring important context to global stories? That all continues on social media. You can find us on Twitter. We are at The World. I'm there too, by the way, at Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. In Haiti, infection can lead to stigma, so many Haitians oppose construction of COVID-19 isolation units.
Because once we got it, then everybody in the community is going to die just because there's a patient there.
How one nurse is navigating those perceptions, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of WGBH Boston and PRX. It's like an ultimatum in an old Western. 72 hours. That's the amount of time the Trump administration is giving China to shut down its consulate in Houston. Here's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo today.
We are setting out clear expectations for how the Chinese Communist Party is going to behave. And when they don't, we're going to take actions that protect the American people, protect our security, our national security, and also protect our economy and jobs.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry called the closing of the consulate an unprecedented escalation. It's the latest salvo in a relationship that seems to be in tatters. Disagreements over Hong Kong, a Chinese tech executive arrested in Canada for possible extradition to the U.S., and consternation over Uyghur concentration camps in western China. The World's Rebecca Canther joins us from Shanghai. So the State Department, Rebecca, says China is interfering with domestic affairs and stealing intellectual property. How does China see this?
Well, that's not the story that people are reading in China. The news of the impending closure has everybody's attention, but how they're understanding what's behind it is very different. I spoke with Professor Shen Dingli. He's an expert on China-U.S. relations, and he explained a theory that's going around that the closure of the Houston consulate is actually a result of a dispute over U.S. consulates in China and the return of American diplomats to them. So he thinks the U.S. order to close the Houston consulate is actually a way to put pressure on China to allow U.S. diplomats back into China. And he's really worried about where that could lead.
Because U.S. closed our consulate in Houston, China should close a U.S. consulate in China. Then the relationship would continue to spiral down. Too bad. I hope this will not be the case.
You know, this worry that he's voicing is something that a lot of people are worried about. Retaliatory consulate closings and just a devolving of the relationship between the U.S. and China.
So the decision to close a consulate comes as U.S. indictments of two Chinese hackers come down. Are they related?
That's very possible. There's a number of theories floating around. An American official, David Stilwell, spoke in an interview earlier this week about suspicious behavior on the part of the Houston Consul General as they were preparing Chinese citizens for a charter flight back to China. So that might have something to do with it as well. From the Chinese side, they say they're being smeared. People are reading more about death and bomb threats received at the Chinese embassy in the U.S. and about Chinese diplomatic mail that's being intercepted. So at today's press conference, Foreign Ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbing had this to say about the Houston consulate closure. So he's saying that the closure would seriously violate international law. He says that the U.S. is sabotaging China-U.S. relations and that the U.S. should change their decision. Otherwise, China will take what he calls legitimate and necessary countermeasures. So the narratives are very different on both sides of the ocean.
How else do you see tensions between China and the U.S. escalating at this point?
Well, I mean, Professor Shen says that this kind of aggressive behavior is not typical of the past 50 years of China-U.S. relations. He says it's much more aggressive, and he's worried about what's coming next. And that's what people here in China are talking about, too. There's a poll going around, and people are speculating which is going to be the first U.S. consulate that the Chinese government will close. Some people are saying maybe it's Hong Kong, but the Wuhan consulate might be the most likely.
The World's Rebecca Cather in Shanghai, thank you very much.
Thank you.
With a new disease like the novel coronavirus, we're constantly running into surprises, and not all of them have been bad. One unexpected twist from the pandemic, premature births have been falling, sometimes drastically in certain places. A preterm birth is any delivery before 37 weeks rather than the usual 40. In some countries, the birth rate of extremely premature infants plummeted by 90%, 90%. Roy Phillip is a neonatologist at University Maternity Hospital in Limerick in Ireland. Professor, your team was one of the first to notice this drop in preemie births. How did you first spot this, and what exactly did you find?
I have to say it all happened incidentally. I was away for a couple of weeks when Ireland went to lockdown. And when I returned, I was talking to my colleagues, and we actually feed our extremely preterm babies as an additional nutrition, a breast milk-based fortifier. So I asked them, why did you not order any new supplies? And they told me, look, there was no need to order because there were no babies. That was a bit of a surprise, but then the same statement was given to me after two more weeks. And that was the trigger for me to look into this. We didn't look at all the spectrum of prematurity. We looked at the extreme end of it based on a weight category, which is a usual proxy for very preterm babies. And we could see that our numbers were really drastically reduced to 70 to 90% in comparison to the previous 20 years in this hospital for the same duration.
So as of right now, Professor, do you have a general explanation of what's going on?
First of all, we don't know what is the exact reason behind it. Our paper is still under peer review. This is an unusual opportunity we got. Never before in the recent past, we had this many variables and confounders put together to the pregnant mother. For example, they were not working. They were at home, potentially less stressed at work because they don't have to go to work, better nutrition, better rest, better sleep. All of these, when you cumulatively apply during pregnancy, there could be potential benefits. So I think depending on the society, the variables might play roles differently.
I mean, it's fascinating. I would have thought that fighting a pandemic, possible unemployment, no commuting would have stressed a lot of pregnant mothers out. And you're saying it's actually perhaps the opposite. Do we know what actually causes premature births in the first place?
You know, that is why I said it could be different in other parts of the world. Mm. Suppose there is a region where the lockdown was imposed, but at the same time, access was not available for pregnancy-related assessments and care, and suppose financial stress and unemployment was mounting, of course, in such areas, I am not expecting the same observation to be seen. The second component of your question is, we actually don't know the exact reason for all of the preterm births. In some situations, we know it could be due to infections, maternal illnesses, and various factors are there. But that would not account for a significant proportion of very premature deliveries where we don't know what's the cause.
So, Professor, since most countries have opened up now, at least partially, have you seen a stabilization in the figures that you've been looking at, or are there still much fewer early births?
This is where I think the interesting part is going to emerge. Depending on how the countries are going to open up on a staged-wise manner, in a normal scenario, this should reverse back to where the previous norm was. Another potential is, and I truly hope that will not happen, in case in some countries there is a need for a lockdown to be imposed again, and if the same pattern is re-emerging then, that should make us really think there is something in it. But at this stage, our study from University Hospital in Limerick and the University of Medical School and all, our observation is for one region of one country only, but I'm already hearing the same picture from many other regions of the world. So hopefully, over the coming months, well-conducted research will add more light into this very interesting topic.
Professor Roy Phillip is a neonatologist at University Maternity Hospital in Limerick in Ireland. He's been telling us about a trend during the pandemic of a drop in premature births in many places around the globe. Professor, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
In Haiti, the healthcare system was among the worst in the Western Hemisphere. That was before COVID-19. And there's now concern that coronavirus cases are being severely underestimated. But since Haiti's first case hit, the pandemic has taken some surprising turns. The World's Ilana Gordon spoke with one nurse about how she and others have been navigating the uncertainty.
Graciela Cadet started to become really anxious in early March. The pandemic hadn't reached the country yet.
We were afraid, very afraid here, because we know all the limitation we have, all the challenges we are facing.
Cadet is Deputy Chief Nursing Officer at the NGO Partners in Health's main teaching hospital of Mirabelay. In a country of some 11 million people, she says this lead hospital only had the capacity to treat about 20 critically ill patients, as in those who might need a ventilator.
So that makes us nervous.
The hospital and a few others did add on some more beds and isolation units. But still, long before COVID-19, Haiti's health system has struggled. Widespread protests over government corruption and a lack of essential resources prompted even doctors to go on strike last fall. Then, on March 19th, Haiti's first two identified coronavirus cases were announced, imported from the U.S. and Europe. Cadet remembers that day well.
It was a nightmare. I received so many calls saying, are you ready? Are you ready?
But she says at first, it was the fear of this new virus, not the arrival of the virus itself, that posed an even bigger threat. As has happened in other countries, people who were thought to be infected with COVID-19 were violently targeted, as were health workers.
Instead of seeing them as hero, they were trying to put shame on them.
Some newer COVID-19 units being built were burned.
They were saying that we don't want COVID-19 unit here because once we got it, then everybody in the community is going to die just because there's a patient there.
Popular rumors circulating claim that hospitals are the ones responsible for killing people. There's even a phrase for this, the coronavirus injection. All of this has impacted care.
People were afraid to come to the hospital. And either they come too late or when they come and you test them, ma'am, you're going to go to the COVID unit because you got coronavirus. They say, no, I'm not going there. I prefer to go home. And some die in their way back to home because they refuse to enter a COVID unit.
Cadet says when her own dear family friend became sick, the woman asked her for advice, but didn't want to come in. She was only brought to the hospital after she was already unconscious.
I'm sure if she came earlier, maybe we could save her. But when I got those thoughts, I said to myself that I did my best.
Haiti has since launched a massive education campaign. On radio, TV, and social media, on how to prevent COVID-19 and how to support people who are infected. Cadet says information is much more widespread.
That helped a lot.
So far, Haiti has not gotten slammed nearly as badly as anticipated.
We expected to have a million cases, but so far we got only 6,000.
Less than 10,000 cases. It's difficult to know the real count. Again, many people aren't getting care or getting tested. The official death toll from COVID-19 is less than 200. Cadet is not entirely sure why this is, but one thing she can see is that many people's attitudes are changing. Now, health workers are being thanked in the community, not vilified.
Oh, when I look back, I said that we come far.
Still, she's uneasy about the future. The biggest outbreak in the Caribbean is just across the border in the Dominican Republic, a place many Haitians go back and forth for work. Cadet's frustrated with testing delays, a lack of coordination, and shortages of personal protective equipment and medical oxygen. Then, just a few weeks ago, Haiti's international airport reopened. Cadet points out that a big Haitian community is just a flight away in Florida, which is now a major hotspot.
I am definitely worried because I am afraid that we're going to have overcrowds of coronavirus cases again.
Haitians have been stuck in the U.S. waiting to get back. Others are being deported. Since flights resumed, at least 40 imported cases have been documented in Haiti, leaving Cadet back to where we started this story, anxious and uncertain. For the World, I'm Alana Gordon.
It's been a while since most of us have gone to a museum. According to social media, what art lovers really miss, they're all about that base. A nice butt. The sculpted kind, that is. A recent social media campaign launched by the Yorkshire Museum in the UK, #BestMuseumBum. It went viral because Lucy Crichton is Yorkshire Museum's archaeology curator. She kicked off the challenge with the derriere of a Roman statue. Why'd you choose this particular bum, Lucy?
Well, we chose this Best Museum Bum because it's just a fantastic piece of Roman art. It would have decorated public baths, we think, in the suburbs of Ibaracum, Roman York. So it's local to us. It's an exotic import. We thought it's a fantastic museum bum.
So I know the Yorkshire Museum has a curated battle series. Is this Roman bum part of that series? And how did that whole series start?
So the Yorkshire Museum has been playing curator battle on Twitter since lockdown began. Like museums across the world, we've been closed since the middle of March. So we've had to be creative in finding ways to engage with the public.
What do you think about all the non-traditional bums that people have been sharing in this viral takeoff of Best Museum Bum, like the bottoms of bumblebees and fish with legs?
I know. People have been so creative. It's been fantastic. There have been bums from the animal kingdom, both in taxidermy variety, but also living animals, but also museums that don't have traditional collections of sculpture and art got really creative. And we had the bums of ships and of other vehicles like trains and even the tail gunner position of a Halifax bomber. So people really got creative in their best museum bum choices.
Yeah, every object has its bum. Now that I think about it, they're kind of everywhere in museums. Is that something art curators are all in on, like the bums in museums? And why? Was it the least offensive body part that artists were willing to take on publicly?
You're right that all museums have bums in one form or another. And there's something universal about the human body. It's been a subject of art and historical objects throughout history. The nude figure has been a popular topic in art for a long time. Why is that? Well, it's universal. We've all got them. But in terms of sharing museum bums and why we thought it was a fun topic to choose, it's because it gives people, including curators and the public, a bit of license to be silly with the collections and have a little bit of fun. And it's a fun way to engage people who perhaps aren't regular museum visitors, who might go to a museum to try and seek out some bums.
Well, these kinds of activities kind of change the perception of museums as being serious places for high-minded art and maybe make them a little more fun.
I think so. I think initiatives like Curator Battle and I think museums having fun on social media can perhaps help to break down some of those perceived barriers to access that museums can face. We try to be as inclusive as possible at York Museums Trust, and museums are looking to diversify their visitors and to be accessible for everyone. So doing fun things on social media is a way to promote our collection and get it out there to parts of society that might not normally walk through our doors.
Lucy Creighton is Yorkshire Museum's archaeology curator. She's been speaking with me about the museum's recent hashtag Best Museum Bum Challenge. Lucy, it's been great talking stone, bronze, and other bums with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
A weird and somewhat sad story played out in western Ukraine this week. In the city of Lutsk, a guy armed with an automatic rifle and grenades took a bus full of people hostage. He demanded to speak with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and made him this proposal. If Zelensky agreed to post a video of himself recommending a 2005 documentary called Earthlings, it was targeting animal cruelty, narrated by Joaquin Phoenix, then the gunmen would release the hostages. President Zelensky decided to give it a try.
Film «Земляне» 2005 года. Смотреть всем.
The film Earthlings from 2005, the president said in the video, everyone should watch it. Soon afterwards, all of the hostages were released. As for the gunman, he's said to be a 44-year-old animal rights activist named Maxim Krivosh. Ukrainian police said he was unstable. After the hostage situation ended, President Zelensky spoke to the press. Zelensky said he made the obvious choice. If we can avoid putting people's lives at risk, he said, these are principles I live with. Nordic countries have exported a slew of buzzwords to the rest of the world. Hygge, Danish for cozy contentment. Lagom, Swedish for finding joy in moderation. Then there's the made-up Nordic word, pants drunk, what it sounds like. Along comes another one, a word with more substance than its predecessors, the Finnish word sisu. During these trying times, this four-letter word may have something of value to offer the rest of the world. Kavita Pillay reports.
Sisu is like courage on steroids.
Like courage on steroids. That's from a TEDx talk about Finland. But sisu is not easily translated into English.
I have a degree as a translator from Finnish into German.
Roman Schatz is a German-born author and journalist.
And I would dare to say that no translator can translate sisu into English or German with just one word.
Schatz has lived in Finland for the past 33 years, and he's written a number of books about his adopted country. In his first book, From Finland with Love, Schatz says that sisu only kicks in when you need it.
It's like a turbo for your engine or something, yeah? You don't need it unless you're going uphill.
As the odds get worse, sisu allows you to become stronger. Over the past century, it's been applied to everything from Finnish Olympians to the country's battle against the Soviet Union in World War II. It's even a Finnish brand of trucks and military vehicles.
Without difficulty, it moves in mountainous areas where other vehicles cannot go. It's manufactured by Sisu in Finland.
Sisu has come to mean facing obstacles and working hard to overcome them. And whether you fail or succeed, you don't draw attention to yourself. Which brings to mind Finland's success with COVID-19. In a country of 5.5 million, they've had just over 320 coronavirus deaths. So far, they've succeeded at containing the disease. And they're not making a big deal about it. By some measures, this might be quintessential sisu. But you won't hear Finns saying that, because here's the thing about sisu. Traditionally, you don't talk about it.
Once you start talking about it, it's not sisu anymore.
This is Tuomas Tepura. He's a historian at Helsinki University.
It's something that you should learn by not mentioning it.
Tepura has written that sisu was coined as a collective quality of a small northern nation who has been forced to endure harsh climate and hostile neighbors. He says that for many Finns, it's one thing to talk about sisu to foreigners, but it can be kind of embarrassing to speak of one's own sisu. And yet, Depora says that Sisu is having a cultural renaissance of sorts.
It's been promoted abroad as something of a trendy character at the moment. That connects Sisu with other Nordic characters, which have been rather fashionable lately.
In fact, several books about Sisu have come out since 2018. It's also rising in popularity as a first name for children in Finland. And in a Helsinki department store, I even found a new Sisu-themed line of face creams. But until recently, it wasn't an easy subject to study.
When I started researching Sisu in 2012-13, so there was really nothing on it.
Emilia Lahti is a psychology researcher and the first person in the world to do a PhD on Sisu.
You know, there was not one single peer-reviewed article, not one single book on Sisu.
Lahti also happens to know something about personal endurance. In 2018, she ran across the entire length of New Zealand in 50 days, all while making stops to talk with people about her past experience in a relationship that involved domestic violence. It's part of her campaign called Sisu, Not Silence. So what does she think about this idea that once you start talking about Sisu, it's no longer Sisu?
No, that sounds like Fight Club. The movie.
The first rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club.
Sisu has been very masculine. And so no wonder if there would be a saying like that, because it would kind of be rising from this space where you're supposed to be quiet and you don't ask for help and you don't discuss your problems.
For Lahti, Sisu is not about keeping quiet. But she says that Sisu is complex and sometimes a double-edged sword. To Roman Schatz, the German-born writer, there is a paradoxical quality to Sisu. Too much strength and resilience might lead you to accept things that you shouldn't.
I sometimes wonder in Finland that this Sisu, the readiness to accept hardship, coldness, rain, sleet, it also has caused some sort of collective, it's the obedience of the lambs, if you know what I mean. You know, Sisu might be misused as some sort of Prozac. Yeah, we have to take it because we can take it.
Prozac or not, something seems to be working. The UN's World Happiness Report has ranked Finland the happiest country in the world for 3 years in a row. Many factors help explain this, like Finland's stable democracy and low levels of corruption and inequity. But Emilia Lahti says happiness isn't quite the right word for it.
I think the Finnish happiness is closer to contentment. It's not the yay, but it's more like, you know?
Like Sisu itself, maybe the Finnish form of happiness isn't so easily translated. For The World, I'm Kavita Pillay.
Kavita Pillay is with the Language Theme podcast subtitle, which is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities. And that's where we say goodbye for today. We're always online at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Stay strong, stay healthy. You know, stay Sisu. Just don't talk about it. We'll see you back here tomorrow.